Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This series of California-based podcasts is brought to you in partnership with the Serica Initiative, our nonprofit program. The mission of the Serica Initiative is to produce independent educational and public awareness programming to make the U.S. and global public better informed about China. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and today I am in Los Angeles, California, the third stop on this Seneca Golden State tour. My guest today is Alex Wong, professor of law at UCLA and a friend of 20 years now. Alex, 20 years now, yeah.
That's true.
Wow. From back in Beijing days. Among other things, he was Jeremy's landlord for a couple of years.
That's true, too.
Had a fleeting career as a rock guitarist in Wuhan, which I think is one of the main things we have in common, yeah. Alex is one of the most highly regarded experts on China's climate and environmental policy, and he's just back from Madrid, where COP25 was held, and is flying out in just a few hours to Beijing, so it's a good thing I caught him here today. And we have lots to talk about regarding China's progress in its challenges in reducing carbon emissions. So, Alex, welcome back to Seneca, man. It's been a while.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. And thank you for inviting me into your lovely home.
Absolutely.
Let's start with your recent trip to Madrid for COP25. So COP, Conference of Parties to the UN Convention on Climate Change. This year, I think most of you probably know it was originally planned to be held in Santiago in Chile, but it was, you know, there's the global uprising against neoliberalism and all that. So yeah, Lebanon's out and Santiago's out. So right. They moved it to Madrid. Well, explain, first of all, for our listeners, what COP25 in Madrid was all about.
Right. Okay. So again, thanks for having me, Kaiser. As you mentioned, I just got back from the Madrid. COP25 ended this weekend. COP25, basically, it's the meeting of the parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was passed in the early 90s. It's the main way that all the countries of the world get together and talk about how to solve climate change. This is the 25th meeting. The short story of this meeting in Madrid was that it was widely viewed as a failure to set up sort of a common understanding about the ambition needed to solve the problem. And I'd be happy to talk about sort of the background of that. It might be useful for those who aren't following the climate negotiations to give a little bit of background. Just, you know, what is this convention? Yeah, yeah. How does the whole thing work? What were our expectations? These types of things.
Right? Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Okay. So the UN convention that was passed in the early 90s sets a goal for the countries of the world to deal with the potential risks of climate change, but it doesn't have a lot of detail as to how to do that. So the first major push to do this was the Kyoto Protocol, which was in some ways a conventional environmental treaty where there were targets for some countries and potential penalties for not meeting those targets. And the basic setup back then was that developed countries who were seen to be responsible for climate change had targets the US, Europe, Japan, other countries. And the developing countries who were not seen to have been the contributors to the problem did not have any binding targets at all. So you might recall that the US didn't join the Kyoto Protocol. And part of the reason that they cited was that major emitters who were developing countries like China were not subject to binding targets.
Right.
So that was agreed to.
Reminds of the year of the.
So this was the late 90s that it was agreed to, but didn't come into effect until the early 2000s.
Right.
And so that then was subsequently replaced by the Paris Agreement, which was agreed to in 2015. Right. And the Paris Agreement, the Kyoto Protocol did not get us really anywhere near where we needed to go. Everyone was looking for a different approach. In the Paris Agreement, the approach is in concept quite different than the Kyoto Protocol. So if you would think of Kyoto Protocol as having narrow participation but with hard targets, what they attempted to do in Paris was to have broad participation, basically to get every country in the world in. Very importantly, China and other major emitters. But the compromise was that what's actually legally binding the Paris Agreement is procedural, is that you have agreed that you will submit a plan as to what you want to do. But that plan, they're called NDCs, National Determined Contributions, and these are essentially each country's own determination of what they can do. And then the way it's supposed to work is by a so-called ratchet effect, where every few years, countries have to submit new plans, there's transparency, and then that sort of peer pressure of everyone knowing what you're doing is supposed to push us towards the agreement. So the reason that part of what was going on in Madrid was that people were hoping that there would be ambitious things said in the run-up to next year, right, which is the year when the countries are submitting have the opportunity to submit their plans. And countries can actually submit more ambitious plans at any time, but next year is one of the milestones.
Next year is Glasgow, right?
In Glasgow, yeah. And so one of the big disappointments was that there were attempts to put in language calling, you know, agreement that there would be big ambition in the next year, and the countries could not agree to.
Not even that. Not even an agreement on language to say that we will be more ambitious next year.
Yeah, I mean, primarily this meeting in Madrid was about some technical issues, working out the rules of carbon markets and some other technical rules. But people were hoping that there would be a good signal for next year.
So, if it's regarded as a failure, is there a culprit behind this? Now, I mean, immediately, of course, today being the day of the impeachment hearings, my mind goes to one person. We're not technically yet out of the Paris Agreement, right?
Right.
That can't happen until election, after the election. Right. Is that correct?
Right. By the rules of the agreement, you know, Trump announced that they were going to withdraw a few months ago, and it doesn't take effect until right after the election.
We did send a delegation, though, right?
Right. So we have State Department officials, people who have always been involved in this, who are there. But the American presence was much lower than it has been in the past. So at Paris, there was a U.S. pavilion, a lot of action. And I think more importantly, you know, what happened in advance of Paris was that in the 2 years leading up to Paris, the U.S. and China orchestrated some major announcements that about what each country planned to do, and that helped create the momentum and created the platform for everyone else to get on board. This time around, there was a lot of just dissension and no common thread of agreement that sort of emerged out of it. And you know, I'm not able to go into the rooms, negotiating rooms, but the news you hear coming out of it is that the major emitters, the U.S. and China, apparently were opposed to language about more ambition.
That's really a pity. Now, ahead of Glasgow next year, there is this summer the EU-China summit in Leipzig. Some people, I remember reading a BBC report on this, are pinning hopes on that so that China and the EU can come to, you know, analogously to what Obama and Xi Jinping came to in 2014 ahead of Paris. They hammered out a climate agreement. Is that something that you're holding out hope for?
Yeah, so I think that would be one positive way that this could go, in that we're going to need to hear announcements well in advance of the meeting at the end of next year. And so that's one opportunity. I think the EU wants to step up, and hopefully they will. But right now we don't know exactly what will come of that.
So, I mean, we're mainly focusing in this podcast, of course, on Chinese attitudes. I think most of our listeners are probably aware that China is now the biggest carbon emitter, and that by cumulative emissions, still China hasn't caught the U.S. China used to be pretty adamant about being regarded as less culpable because it had low per capita emissions.
Yeah.
But even that is really no longer the case, right? I mean, that.
Yeah, so it's worth talking about this debate about responsibility. I mean, what one of the things that's going on at these meetings is an argument over who's responsible, who should take the burden of doing this, right? So the developing country argument, including the argument from China, is that the U.S. and Europe are largely responsible for historical emission. That's what matters, right? This is a cumulative thing in the atmosphere that contributes to climate change. And so the developing countries say, look, you guys did it. You need to cut more than us. You need to provide money so that we can cut ourselves, and we can adapt to the harm that's sure to come from sea level rise, from extreme weather, and all these things that we know are coming because of climate change. And so, and the developed countries are naturally are resistant to that because it's money, it's tremendous amounts of money, it's a lot of responsibility for these countries. So what China will say is that the U.S. and Europe are the most responsible because of their historical emissions. But of course, the situation with China is that these days are by far the largest emitter in absolute emissions. And as you mentioned, in terms of per capita, 10 years ago, the argument was, look, each Chinese person emits much less than every American. That's unfair to require us to do as much as you. That seems to be Americans or Europeans taking their an unfair share of the budget left. But these days, China's emissions now have surpassed per capita on a per capita basis European emissions.
Mm.
I think the other thing that we have to also keep in mind in the discussion is the way that emissions are measured right now is by country. But of course, trade matters, right? A lot of the emissions produced in China are for consumption in the US and Europe and Japan and the developed countries. But at the same time, as China's gotten wealthier, they are now going through the same process that the developed countries did, which is sort of exporting emissions.
Right.
So we can talk about that later, but with Chinese outbound investment, a lot of the emissions of Chinese people are now being sent outside. So I think the responsibility argument is very fraught. This is why there's often very slow progress at the negotiations. But the long and the short of it is that China needs to reduce its emissions, right?
Yeah.
Because in order to solve the problem, all the best science shows that we need to have massive cuts in the near future. So in the next 10 years, massive cuts going towards basically neutrality, carbon neutrality towards 2050. So if you imagine, that's 30 years from now.
Yeah,
that's a major transition in 30 years.
Is China as insistent as it used to be about transfers, about being treated as a developing country, or has their tone changed somewhat? Are they more willing to pony up and less insistent on being treated?
Yeah, so the Chinese position has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. So I was at the Copenhagen meeting with my colleagues at NRDC at that time. And if you recall, Copenhagen was a very contentious meeting.
Oh, yeah.
China was very aggressive on pushing these arguments about who was responsible, really saying that the U.S. and others were should take a larger share. But after that meeting, you know, that meeting was largely viewed as a failure. A lot of blame was placed on China. And I think since then, the Chinese climate program, the climate policy program, has really matured dramatically. And it's for a variety of reasons. And China's very straightforward about this in their official documents on this. Why are they doing it? They say that it's because they know that China will be affected by climate change. They know it's good for their economy. China now is anticipating this sort of economic transformation from an industrial society to sort of a post-industrial society. And as we know, you know, air pollution, environmental degradation, all of these things have reached sort of crisis levels at China. So all of those things drove a change in China. If you look at the climate policy program, whereas 10 to 15 years ago, it was a hodgepodge of pre-existing programs. Mm-hmm. These days, it's a very mature, sophisticated blend of really all of the components that anyone would say that you need in order to tackle climate change. And I think the big question now is, can we get China to be more ambitious, to move faster, and to move more decisively? So it's a different story, obviously, than in the U.S., where you have many people in the U.S. Saying the same thing, wanting to decarbonize. But of course, with Trump and the federal government, they are doing sort of everything in their power to thwart that and to move in the opposite direction on climate change.
Just now, you talked about how, given the interconnectedness of our global trading system, and that, you know, China is shouldering so much of the manufacturing for the world, maybe a country-based emissions metric isn't the best. What is the alternative to that? Is it a consumption-based metric, or what do you?
Yeah, so I don't know what the, you know, I think a country-based is still the way it's going to be for the future. But I raise it only to for really two reasons. I think it's worth raising because it tempers some of the tone of the debate, sort of suggesting, you know, in the past when I was saying, look, it's all China, I think the U.S. and Europe had to accept some responsibility that some of those emissions were partly the responsibility of the developed countries. However, it of course is still mainly the responsibility of the country that's emitting them, right? But likewise, as China starts to go out, there's a lot of responsibility for the countries that are now becoming the homes of the emissions. But China also likewise has some responsibility to try to control that, because that's partly Chinese consumption. But as an accounting matter, I think it's going to be country-based for...
Yeah, I do want to talk about what initiatives like the Belt and Road are doing in terms of China's outsourcing carbon emissions. But first, I guess the reason that I thought that it would be a good idea to have this conversation right now is that over the last few years, I think I've been reading a lot of reporting that was fairly sanguine about China's progress. There was a lot, I mean, in a sea of otherwise very negative reporting on China, at least you would see, you know, people making the claim that China was really in the lead on a few key issues, for example, on renewables, that they had, it was basically because of the China price that we had significantly reduced the cost to produce a kilowatt hour of solar or wind. But recently that has really shifted. We're seeing a lot of reports now about how China is now actually firing up more coal-fired power plants and that emissions are not decelerating as they were. At the same time, China is still doing, you know, well in other ways. Give us the balance sheet. A rundown of where China's leading and where China's lagging.
Right. So in the run-up to Madrid, we saw a number of media reports on kind of this question of, is China a climate leader or a laggard? I think that debate was always a little bit overblown. I think it's hard to say that you're a climate leader when you are emitting a third of the carbon emissions in the world, right? So, but what that debate was highlighting was that China both was contributing to the problem in many ways, but also had sort of directionally moved in the right direction on policy, and also in some major ways was playing a transformative role. And I'll talk about those. So I think on the good side of the balance sheet, I think China's actions on renewable energy and electric vehicles have been arguably transformative, right? Mm. So if you want to talk about what we need to do to decarbonize, right? So two of the major things are, where do we get our energy?
Mm-hmm.
And second is transportation.
How do we get around?
Transportation is largely oil, right? And then energy, it's been powered by coal. In the U.S., now increasingly natural gas, but still fossil fuels, right? So on the renewable energy side, you really need to move to wind, solar, you know, hydro is part of the mix, but essentially non-fossil sources of energy. And on the wind and solar front, for example, China has been by far the largest sort of producer and investor in renewables over the last few years. And their actions on renewables have led to dramatic price decreases on wind turbines, on solar panels, on batteries, these types of things. And that is not only good for China, but good for the world, right? I recently installed solar on my house, mm-hmm. and the price of it compared to some of my colleagues who did it a few years ago is probably about half what they paid just a few years ago.
And so, are China's contributions just in production or implementation as well?
And they're also installing a tremendous amount of renewable capacity. So China is just a large place, so the numbers always tend to be impressive. But if you think of China's renewable installed capacity right now is larger than the entire energy capacity of Japan. It's 3 to 4 times Germany's entire energy capacity, right? Just in renewables. And so, you know, again, partly that's just because China's a large place, but on an absolute measure, China is an enormous user of renewable energy. And so that matters a lot. And then also on the electric vehicles front, the other thing that we really need to do is to electrify or at least move away from fossil fuels for transportation.
Right.
So, for example, in California right now, really to meet its air pollution and climate targets, largely by 2050, the plans suggest that all sales of vehicles at that point are electric vehicles.
By 2050.
Right? We don't know if we'll get there, but that's what people say is needed in order to meet the targets. And right now, China has become the largest market for electric vehicles with about 45% of the electric vehicles in the world. Right, Europe and the U.S. are a little less than a quarter each. But China by far is the leader on that. There have been headwinds though recently because they're starting to pull back on some of the subsidies. And just a few months ago, the sales year on year of EVs dropped by something like 45%. I think the analysts that I've read say, in part it's trying to thin out the market. Right now there's, everyone and his brother jumped into the market.
Right.
And now you're trying to reduce subsidies, and so that
it's the drop in subsidies that seems to have been
right. But hopefully it'll weed out some of the fly by night companies, and then you get the better champions staying in the game. But on those two fronts, those are tremendous contributions to climate change. At the same time, those markets very much tie into the tensions between the U.S. and China. There are trade complaints on, sort of subsidies for these markets, the complaints that illegal subsidies for. But from the environmental perspective, it's nothing but good.
I want to ask you about why it is that these coal power plants are starting up again. And I think that does tie to the trade war. But first, while we're still on electric vehicles, has China had the same sort of impact on the price for core components of EVs that they've had in solar and in wind? I mean, that's one of the main things that has China brought battery prices down in particular?
Yeah, so I'd have to double check that. I think it's not as dramatic yet, but I think I think it would be what would happen once you get more further expansion of those markets.
Yeah, it's just the sheer scale of it. Yeah. It's impressive.
Right. But so that's the good side, right? But on the worrisome side is that there's evidence that China's building more coal plants right now, at a time where you really need to see drops in coal. So China's, the share of coal in the energy mix is dropping, right? Sort of the percentage of coal in the energy mix has dropped below 60% for the first time.
It was over
80%. It used to be in the 70-80%. And that's because gas and renewables and other types of things are increasing. But you've also seen investment in new coal-fired power plants, so rather substantial amounts of new coal-fired power, and that's not a good thing because investors in those will want to use those resources, and it's going to be hard to reduce coal if you're building new capacity. And what seems to be driving it is stimulus, right? So what seems to be going on is, well, there's two things. There's the new construction in coal-fired power plants, but also just upticks in coal use in general. So what's going on? It seems to be in part stimulus the age-old need of local officials to sort of stoke GDP. So one of the ways they're doing it is approving new power plants, but also investment in real estate seems to be driving demand for steel and cement and these types of things. And those are all
very
high heat, heavy industry that needs coal and generates a lot of carbon emissions. And so you know, why is that happening? You know, we chatted earlier a little bit about the potential role of the trade war, right? And you know, we've already seen that China's GDP growth is slowing anyway, but certainly the trade war is putting more pressure on that, and that instability is not helpful for environmental goals for sure.
These new plants that are coming online, is there any silver lining to them? I mean, are they at least more efficient? Are they?
So it's possible. I haven't looked at the specific plans, but you know, the trend has been that when the new ones get built within China, they are efficient. So if what's going on is that they are shutting down older, more backward technology, which there have been some orders from the center to, for example, the major central state-owned enterprises to shut down heavily indebted kind of marginal properties. So on balance, you know, there may be some offsetting of this new capacity, but new capacity at a time when the existing capacity is underutilized doesn't make any sense from an energy planning perspective. So there's no real good silver lining to this.
Does nuclear figure in at all in any meaningful way in China's energy mix right now? And is there are there plans on the books to increase that?
Yeah, there has been some growth in nuclear, but it's I think moderated in part by what happened in Japan with Fukushima, and I personally would be worried about that. I think sure. It's not the most efficient way to generate energy, especially right now. You have solar and wind; the prices of those coming to parity with
explain what you mean by parity.
Just the price of it has dropped, right? So it used to be more expensive. You know, one of the knocks against renewables was that it's expensive, right? You might build it, and sure, it's great for the environment, but it's expensive. But now it's getting cheaper and cheaper, and you know, I think it'll be something that should be competitive with any other type of energy. So, nuclear, you know, I'm not an expert in nuclear, but it, I don't see it being a major piece of the pie going forward.
There are some countries where it's a pretty substantial piece of the energy. France, sure. Let's get to the Belt and Road and other outbound investment from China and what that's actually doing. What has been the carbon impact of BRI and other major investments?
Yeah, so there are now a number of studies coming out. There was recently a very good report by the World Resources Institute on this, basically identifying that a lot of the energy sector outbound investment from China was for investment in fossil fuels, and a lot of the power plants that were being invested in were of less advanced technology. Mm. So the conclusion of the WRI report was that this was just completely inconsistent with Paris goals and that it would lock in for the foreseeable next few decades a increasing sort of carbon emissions trajectory. And if you recall, in order to meet the goals within the international agreements, we're talking about trying to move to carbon neutrality by 2050 or 2070, you know, depending on which estimates you look at. And so you really... the disconnect between what's needed to combat climate change and what seems to be going on in investment trajectories could not be greater right now.
That's just depressing. Is it on the recipient countries or is it on China?
So I think it's both, right? So there's evidence. Kelly Sims Gallagher at Tufts has mm-hmm. done some research that showed the fossil fuel investments were often an ask from the, you know, there's a pull from the host countries, the developing countries that are getting the investment are asking for fossil fuels, and the companies in China are obliging by providing the product. But, you know, Chinese financing is involved, and that's a place where they can make pledges to not provide funding for fossil fuel investments. And so I think it's on both sides. But so it, you know, clearly you can do it's a little bit easier to concentrate your efforts in Beijing and try to get several major banks and major companies to make pledges. Once you go out into the world, then you're talking about dozens of countries.
It's much
more difficult.
And I mean, since we are looking now at parity pricing and the actual capital outlays for a solar installation aren't crippling compared to, can't China say, hey, can I interest you in some wind or solar instead?
I think that would be the idea. So I think hopefully the direction is that developing countries around the world can be convinced that the path to development is through more use of renewable energy, that you don't need to. I think there's some idea among developing countries that the path is the one that China went through, which is pollute first and then deal with it later. And then when you're rich, then you can move.
This is not an option.
And so now that's completely, again, inconsistent with the what we need to do on climate change. And so, but you know, this is a place where, you know, links directly with the discussions in the international climate negotiations, which is, will the developed countries help these countries? So there may be a picture where companies from the developed countries get involved, and they can sort of make some money by providing these technologies, but also with some support from subsidies and assistance to help these developing countries make it more affordable for them.
So Alex, part of the reason that I'm here and doing these podcasts out of California is I'm really interested in the way that the state of California is cooperating with China, in this administration. I mean, this is one of the things that I think a lot of people who I talk to have noticed. Attitudes about cooperation with China are shifting because the Trump administration is so at war with Beijing that state capitals are taking up a lot of the slack. And I think that's probably nowhere more pronounced than in the state of California. And one of the things I'm really interested in is what is the initiative that under former Governor Jerry Brown was started and that Gavin Newsom has really continued to pursue with China right now. So can you talk about it? You're involved, or your institution's involved in this initiative. Can you talk about it a little bit, what UCLA is doing with the UC systems?
Yeah, so I think in general, and this has been going on for quite a number of years, that there's been a lot of collaboration between California and China, right? So as Governor Brown used to love saying, California is the fifth largest economy in the world, a major player. Governor Brown was very present at the Paris conference in 2015. And so what California is trying to do on climate change is very similar in concept to what China now is trying to do, right? And so there's efforts to reduce reliance on carbon intensive fuels and a very elaborate set of plans to deal with climate change and air pollution and other related problems. So there's been a lot of sharing in the energy sector, on wind and solar technology, on governance, on environmental law, these types of things. And so one of the initiatives is this initiative that Governor Brown launched after just going to China and meeting with Xi Jinping, which is it's called the California China Climate Change Institute. It's based up at Berkeley, but it's a UC-wide initiative that involves us at UCLA and folks at Davis who do a lot of work on transportation, Lawrence Berkeley Labs, and others. And in some ways, it's a continuation of the types of things that have been going on for a long time and taking advantage of the expertise in California, both in the universities and in Cal EPA. Cal EPA has, I believe, more than 2,000 staffers working on...
It's probably bigger than the federal.
No, it's not bigger than the federal. Federal has, 17,000. Okay. It did before the Trump administration. But they're doing incredible work. They have they are a world leader, really, on carbon cap and trade, on trying to electrify the transportation sector, trying to reduce amount of carbon and fuel and these types of things. And so, I think it's not enough because you really need to have the U.S. federal government involved.
Right.
It's not sufficient to have a combative anti-climate change federal government next to a major state, even if California is the fifth largest economy in the world. The work that we and a lot of others are doing in California is trying to sort of keep things moving while there's this, hopefully, an interregnum in the federal context. but given the magnitude of the problem, is completely not enough. So, I mean, the types of projects that we're doing and others are doing, you know, we're right now doing work on air pollution and climate co-control. So California has for a long time been thinking about how do you deal with both of these problems in the most efficient way, right? There's a lot of overlap. Good transportation policy deals with air pollution and climate change.
Right.
And what's appealing to the Chinese side about that is that the political momentum for air pollution is just stronger, right? Because it's much more in your face, as you know.
In your lungs.
Right. So people want that to be solved. So if you can be smart about the planning of that, you can kind of maximize the benefit to both. Right. So obviously renewable energy, if you have less power coming from coal-fired power plants, that's also both good for climate change and for air pollution. And there's lots of different ways that that California right now is trying to plan to do that better. China also, you know, in their official plan, they talk about coal control. This idea is in the mix in China, but I think it's this idea that I like the positioning that says, look, both sides have not completely figured out how to deal with this problem, and they're working together to try to solve it. So,
what sorts of things that California has been doing is China particularly attracted by, aside from things like co-control? For example, are they looking at the carbon credit trade market?
So the carbon markets, that's a second project that it looks like we'll be getting involved in. So California has had a cap and trade system, carbon cap and trade system, for a number of years, and China, they've officially launched it, but it hasn't really gotten going yet. They officially launched it in 2017, and the announcement was that it would be primarily for the power sector, but they're still working out the rules right now, and I believe next year we'll really commence the active trading, and immediately then China becomes one of the major markets in the world. One thing that's been a little bit misunderstood in the media presentation of the China market is that what they're trading, the China system is actually not a cap and trade system. Mm-hmm. And they're very open about this. It's actually a tradable performance standard, meaning what you're trying to do is improve the efficiency of power plants. So technically there's no cap, because if a power plant at the end of the year has just produced more, they get actually more credits. Basically, they just have to sort of meet a certain efficiency amount of carbon per unit of power emitted, whereas California isn't actually a cap. It's understandable in some ways in a economy that's still growing as fast as China, but obviously this is something, even in the plans and the researchers that we worked with at Tsinghua, the idea is that they would like to see down the road a hard cap on this, but it's not part of official Chinese policy yet.
You say the media has gotten, I've seen misreporting about the carbon credit market in China. I mean, people actually saying there is one when there hasn't been. We were talking earlier about media reportage on the sort of leader laggard question. Yeah. Where do you think maybe you ought to correct the record a bit?
Yeah, well, on the carbon market reporting, there have been pilots at the provincial and city level for the last since 2013. So there have been local level pilots. There has not been a national emissions trading system. That's really just getting going, and what we hope to do some work with Tsinghua. So, you know, on the leader laggard question, I think the question is a little bit beside the point. In part, there's a little calling China a leader was also
premature. Yeah.
Well, in part, it was to sort of try to shame Trump for pulling back, right? To say, look, you're missing out on an opportunity, because China does see an advantage in trying to build its renewable industry, its EV industry, these types of things. That's good for China's economy, right? And the U.S., at least from the federal perspective now, is just saying, look, we're not going to compete there. We're going to try to maintain the line on what, you know, sort of the strong industries, the oil industries, the auto industries of the past, right? And so I think with China, what's good is that the policy is directionally correct. I think what is insufficient right now, as it is in the U.S. and in Europe, is the level of ambition, right? Mm-hmm. All countries need to go much more aggressively towards decarbonizing. And so in that sense, China is a laggard in that the planning is insufficient right now. But it is good that they're not denying that climate change is real. It's good that they're not, you know, trying to roll back climate policy, these types of things. But as we see from the power plant stuff, there is insufficient implementation, right? So the policy can be directionally good, but it doesn't matter if Shandong province is permitting power plants and not shutting them down when they're told to, and then that is allowed to continue, right?
So as we've got a year before COP26, I suppose, in Glasgow, what are some optimistic and pessimistic scenarios going into that next meeting?
Well, so, you know, from the U.S. perspective, a lot will turn on the election. If Trump wins again, then we're going to have four more years of no.
And we'll really be out of Paris.
Policy. Yeah, and we'll actually be out of Paris. In the same way that we were out of the Kyoto Protocol, you know, State Department officials will continue to be observers at these meetings, but they won't be a member of the Paris Agreement, right? They won't actively be involved. And so I think for environmental purposes, there has to be a democratic president, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. In terms of what's going on with China, what I would love to see, China's in the middle of doing their next five-year plan. So there's a lot of research going on, a lot of ideas being bandied about in both directions, right? There's some people saying that we want to increase the coal cap, allow for some more coal. You know, that's good for energy security. That's good for the economy, these types of things. But it's terrible for climate change policy, right? And so hopefully what we'll see in the next five-year plan is ambitious targets to more aggressively move towards what China has already said is its stated goal, which is economic transformation, moving away from heavy industry and doing what they're calling eco-civilization and greening the economy. So all the pieces are there, and there are a lot of players who are actively supporting these things. But you know, there's been a sort of one step forward, two steps back so far.
It's clear that consciousness about air pollution is you know, very high in China right now. What about climate change? I mean, are they reacting, for example, to these new reports about Shanghai being partially underwater? And do you feel like popular consciousness about climate change is increasing? Was China reporting on Greta Thunberg and Climate Week in New York?
So I think people in general in China are supportive of climate change. You know, there were some polls that were a high percentage of Chinese people said they'd be willing to pay a little bit more to deal with climate change. But you know, that there's a difference between your belief and your behavior, right? Sure. It's hard to change individual behavior, right? As China is becoming a higher, wealthier, higher consuming nation, people's actions are inconsistent with climate change. But I think the biggest thing that has to happen is at the policy level, because if you have wholesale changes in where the energy is coming from, what types of vehicles are available on the market, then it makes it easier for people to make the right individual choices, right? That's how you make the wholesale change at the speed that you need.
At the level of macroeconomics, is the rebalancing underway in the Chinese economy moving away from an investment-driven, export manufacturing-driven economy and more toward a domestic consumption-driven economy? Is that good for carbon emissions or bad?
Oh, so yeah, if that happens, it's definitely good for carbon emissions, right? You know, I tell my students at the law school that they are a high GDP, low carbon emissions industry, right? So they are, each one of them goes out to a law firm. They produce a lot of, generate a lot of income without producing as much carbon, and then you can insert your lawyer joke about hot air right there. But yeah, if you actually move away from steel and cement and these types of things, obviously, you know, the services industries are much less carbon intensive.
I imagine that was the case. Just wanted to make sure. So, Alex, it's been fantastic talking to you about this. It's as depressing as a topic as it is. I think it's really great to have some light shed on this. Let's move on now to recommendations. But first, let me remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter. This thing is still just chock full of great reads on China. delivered to your inbox every weekday. Jeremy, Lucas, Anthony, Jiayun, they all work really hard to bring you this product, and it is terrific value for money. Check it out. Sign up, spread the word. Okay, recommendations, man. Alex, what do you have for us?
Okay, so I'm going to give two. So great. At Madrid last week, this is a sort of a shout out to a University of California colleague, David Victor down at UCSD, UC San Diego, launched a report called Accelerating the Low Carbon Transition. It was commissioned by the UK government. And it looks like a great, I'm in the middle of looking through it, but it looks like a great report that has sort of very granular steps as to how you get from here to there. So I think it's very important when there's a lot of coverage for the activists calling for more ambition, but we also need a lot of work on exactly how we get there. This is a great report if you're interested in knowing what needs to be done. It shows a lot of positive things, like in areas of energy and transportation, we actually have ways to get there. But a lot of other areas like aviation and these types of things, we are still at the very beginning of figuring out how to decarbonize. So that's one. And I would be remiss to not give a shout out to my own UCLA colleague. So my colleague Ted Parson at UCLA has the third edition of his book, The Science and Politics of Global Climate Change, a book he did with Andrew Dressler. And it talks... it's a great overview about both the science of climate change and the politics of it and the negotiations in the international context. So that's a good read if you want to find out more about that.
Oh, that's great. I mean, mine were going to be completely frivolous in comparison. I went off topic. I mean, a friend of mine turned me on to this Netflix series from Russia. It's called Trotsky. It's this little 8-part miniseries. It's terrific. It's a sort of a biopic, very salacious, you know, his affair with Frida Kahlo in Mexico. And it starts, I mean, there's it's, you know, it's R-rated, I suppose, but it's quite good. It's subtitled quite well in English. You know, Trotsky comes up, you know, very much larger than life. All the usual cast of characters in it. I'm still only, you know, on episode 3 or 4. You know, the Kronstadt rebellion has just happened. Kerensky's regime is still in power. But it's fascinating. It's not historically accurate necessarily. Don't count on it for that. But pretty different from Isaac Deutscher's trilogy about Trotsky, but I recognize the man all the same. Check it out. It's a pretty fascinating thing.
Okay.
Thanks, Alex. What are you watching on Netflix these days? What, you got any good TV shows?
I've been watching The Watchmen.
Isn't that great?
I need to watch the last episode still, but that's been great.
I won't spoil it for you. It's great. Yeah. I mean, I love Lindelof. I think he's just did you see The Leftovers?
I didn't see that, but this has been a great show.
The guy knows how to make really tell a really good story. Yeah. Terrific story. Yeah, terrific. I recommended it actually a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by me, Kaiser Guo, and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out the other podcasts in our network. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.